Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Halloween is a time for dressing up, watching horror movies, and going trick-or-treating. It is the one day of the year where the main purpose is to be scared and to scare others. However, amid all of the harmless activities and fun of the season, violence can occur and genuine fear can be felt. All of the gruesome murders detailed in this episode took place around Halloween time, giving Halloween some legitimacy to the ominous nickname, Devil's Night. Yoshihiro Hattori was a 16-year-old Japanese exchange student who moved in with the Haymaker family in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in August of 1992. He was affectionately known by his friends and family as Yoshi. Yoshi was the third exchange student that the Haymakers had hosted, and the second from Japan. Yoshi settled in perfectly. He enjoyed fishing with the family and always made sure to help out with his share of the chores. Brian Haymaker said, "He was just a gregarious guy. He was throwing his heart into everything. He was making friends. He was adventurous. He was having trouble with English, but he was going on anyway." When Yoshi came to America, he became a student at McKinley High School, where he was known as a fun, loving student who almost always had a smile on his face. His classmates said that he could always make them laugh, especially when he randomly broke out into a Western dance step. His friend, Mandolin Fawn, said, "No matter who was rude to him, no matter what happened, he always had a smile on his face." On the 17th of October, Yoshi and the teenage son of the Haymakers, Webb, made their way to East Brookside Drive to attend a Halloween costume party. Yoshi had dressed up as John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever and was wearing a tuxedo with a white jacket and jewelry wrapped around his neck. It was the perfect costume for Yoshi, who was known for his impromptu dances.
What was the mood? What was the plan?
I'm in my room. Yoshi walks in and says, "Mom, can you help me with this outfit?" He's just all excited and ready to go, because he's going to be John Travolta. It was very upbeat.
Webb was wearing regular clothing. The party was being held at the host family of another Japanese exchange student and had been arranged as a way for other exchange students to meet up. Most of the students in attendance were exchange students, and Yoshi had been looking forward to making some new friends. When they arrived in the neighborhood, they went up to house 10311. Despite the fact that the home was decorated for Halloween, they were at the wrong house. Yoshi and Webb had transposed two numbers in the address of the house where the party was being held and ended up at 10311 instead of 10131.
And we saw the house, and we saw a house, and the address was close. And they had three cars in the driveway and Halloween decorations all around. So we thought that S would probably be the place.
This house belonged to Rodney Pierce and his wife Bonnie. Yoshi and Webb stand on the front door in the cool winter air and knocked on the door. Bonnie opened the door, screamed, and then slammed it closed. she hollered to Rodney to go and get his gun. When Yoshi and Webb realized that they must have been at the wrong house, they turned around to walk back towards their car.
So we were confused, and we walked away.
As they were standing on the footpath outside the house, Rodney appeared at the door beside the carport, armed with a .44 Magnum revolver. He shouted at the teenagers to freeze, but Yoshi, who was just learning English, obviously didn't understand what this command meant. Yoshi shouted out, "We're here for the party," as he proceeded to walk towards Rodney. It isn't known for sure, but there's every chance that Yoshi thought that the gun was a prop, part of the party. When Yoshi didn't freeze, Rodney fired his gun point blank at him before running back inside. Webb ran next door to request assistance from Rodney's neighbour, who called for an ambulance. Neither Rodney nor his wife offered assistance. They even shouted at a neighbour to go away when they came to help. Webb and the neighbour, Stanley Luckey, attempted to comfort Yoshi, who was sobbing and crying. Rodney stayed inside the house until the police arrived. Tragically, Yoshi died on the way to the Earl K. Long Medical Center. He had been shot once in the chest. The bullet had perforated his lung and exited out his back. As news of the shooting swept across the city, many people were left questioning how something so tragic could have transpired. Holly Haymaker, whose family had been hosting Yoshi, said that if Rodney had in fact shouted freeze at Yoshi, he wouldn't have understood what it meant. As Holly said, Yoshi struggled with English. Rodney was taken into custody, but he was not arrested. Major Bud Connor said that there was no criminal intent on the part of Rodney and stated that he was well within his rights to shoot Yoshi. The information regarding the case was turned over to the District Attorney's Office for a decision to be made on whether any action would be taken. It would be determined that Rodney would be facing a grand jury investigation. Just the day after the shooting, all of Japan's national TV networks offered a lesson in English, as the anchors explained how the word freeze can be used to mean, "Don't move or I'll shoot you." The shooting was massive news in Japan, where the shooting of anybody, particularly teenagers, was extremely rare. In fact, officials of both the government and the student sponsoring programs said that they had never even thought that it was necessary to teach high school students how to deal with possible gun attacks. At the time, tensions between America and Japan were high, and the shooting only played into that, with a lot of people saying that the shooting had reflected a decline in American society. As one TV reporter in Japan said, "America, what a country. You can't even walk around outside and be safe. Many people live in fear all the time over there."
Once again, the eyes of the world were upon the violence in our society. Of course, no country's scrutiny was more intense than Japan's. There, violent crime is far less frequent than in the U.S., and only the police and military are allowed to have guns. So there were endless news reports trying to explain the unexplainable.
On the 20th of October, a memorial service was held at the Unitarian Church of Baton Rouge, where around 300 mourners packed in. During the emotional service, Yoshi's mother, Miko Hattori, said that she and her husband felt sorry for Rodney. Turning to the crowd, she said, "We are sorry in our awareness of Mr. Pierce's suffering from this most unfortunate event." She went on to say that she was perplexed by how easily accessible guns are in America before stating, "Without them, Mr. Pierce wouldn't have been put in the position he's in right now." Her words prompted a standing ovation from the mourners. Holly Haymaker also spoke during the service. She recollected how on the first day that Yoshi entered her home, he put his arms around her and called her mom. She described how he slotted right in with the family and was an integral part. She said that he liked to keep his room tidy and always danced in the kitchen. Towards the end of the service, Yoshi's father, Masachi Hitori, thanked the crowd for coming to bid farewell to his son, who had to leave the world with much undone. He said that despite their heartache, his family were dedicated to the mission Yoshi had undertaken to make friends in America and strengthen the ties between Japan and the United States. In a news conference the following day, Rodney's lawyer, Lewis Unglesby, said that Rodney felt great regret over what he had done. He said that his client was not a criminal, but a person who was afraid of becoming a crime victim. He said that it was dark that night, and Rodney hadn't realized that Yoshi was dressed up for a Halloween party.
It's a one in a million thing. Everything had to go wrong simultaneously for these two people to collide in the universe the way that they did.
In early November, it was revealed that the grand jury had rejected a second-degree murder charge and instead returned an indictment against Rodney for shooting Yoshi. Following the decision, Rodney surrendered, and his lawyer announced that he expected his client to post bond and be released pending trial. Just the following day, Rodney posted a $100,000 property bond and was released from custody while awaiting trial. He pleaded not guilty to the charge. Following his release, Rodney spoke with CNN and said that he was sorry for what he had done and that he wanted to meet Yoshi's family to apologize. He said, "It hurts in ways I can't explain." He said that when he told Yoshi to freeze, he continued to move forward and that his behavior in not obeying his command to stop had frightened him so much that he shot him.
It was terror. I could see this fear that I'd never seen before, and actually her telling me to go get the gun. I didn't ask any questions.
Within a month of the shooting, Japan collected over 800,000 signatures on a petition urging the United States to adopt stricter gun control. They presented U.S. Ambassador Michael Armacost with the petition, who said that the petition would make a positive contribution to the debate on gun control in America. He also said that he would transmit the petition to the White House. Rodney's trial would begin in May of 1993. During opening statements, defense Unglesby said that Rodney shot Yoshi because he thought that he was protecting his wife and three children from an intruder. Prosecutor Doug Moriu asked the jurors not to judge Rodney as a person, but judge his conduct on the night of the shooting. He described Rodney as criminally negligent and said that he should be convicted of manslaughter. He said that when Rodney opened the door after it had been slammed closed by Bonnie, Yoshi had interpreted it as an invitation to the party they had been searching for. Jurors would get the chance to examine the murder weapon, as well as the ripped and bloody tuxedo that Yoshi had been wearing. They heard a recorded interview between Rodney and investigators. He described how Bonnie told him to get his gun, and he didn't even question why. He said that when he went outside, he saw Yoshi wearing a white suit and carrying something, which turned out to be a camera. He said that Yoshi appeared to be laughing, but when he failed to stop, he shot him. He said that he was protecting his family, but when asked if he knew what he was protecting them from, he said no. Both Bonnie and Rodney testified and claimed that they had feared for their lives. Bonnie said, "He was coming real fast, so it just came to my mind that he was coming to hurt us, that he was going to come into our house." She said that she wasn't thinking at all. Under cross-examination, the prosecutor argued that the actions of the couple were not reasonable. He said that it hadn't been reasonable for a man of 6 feet 2 inches tall to be afraid of a friendly and unarmed 130-pound boy who rang the doorbell before walking away. He hadn't attempted to break in. He wasn't wearing a scary mask. He wasn't armed. Following the testimony, the jury were sent away to deliberate. Under Louisiana law, homicide can be justified for a number of reasons, including what is known as the shoot the burglar law, which allows people to protect themselves from intruders. It took the jury just 3 hours to reach a verdict. They found Rodney not guilty of manslaughter. Many in court applauded when the forewoman announced the verdict. Yoshi's parents said that they were not surprised by the verdict, but disappointed. Rodney was later found to be liable to Yoshi's parents for $650,000 in damages. With this money, Yoshi's parents founded two charities in their son's name. One was to fund US students wanting to visit Japan, while the other was for gun control.
It's bad enough that you happen to pull a gun on a human being, to use it and to know that it may have been an innocent person, and it actually was an innocent person. It has a terrible impact.
His parents presented President Bill Clinton with a signature signed by 1.7 million Japanese citizens, calling for stricter gun laws, and they became big supporters of the Brady Bill, which mandated background checks and a 5-day waiting period for the purchase of guns in the United States. The shooting of Yoshi had truly been instrumental in the passage of the bill.
7 days after my son's death, we began the petition drive for handgun control in the United States. Today, to Washington, D.C., we bring 1.7 million signatures collected in Japan. We started the petition because we love America just as Yoshi did. The Japanese people signed the petition in the hope that the United States will become a safer country. Changes may come little by little, but we are sure that one day a safe America will come true. Only when that happens, Yoshi's life will not have been wasted.
Following his acquittal, Rodney claimed that he would never own a gun again and admitted that he had overreacted to his wife's fear. It was Halloween night of 2011 when 18-year-old Taylor Van Dyst was adding the final touches to her zombie costume. Taylor loved Halloween and had spent much of the past week watching all of the seasonal horror movies that were up on television. Just the day beforehand, she had posted on Facebook about her Halloween costume, asking her friends if she should dress up as a zombie or a wood nymph. When she was ready, at around 5:50 p.m., she left her home in Armstrong, British Columbia, to meet her friend and go trick-or-treating. Next, we will hear from Taylor's aunt.
Her face was white, painted white, and she had some kind of fake blood. So kind of like gruesome looking, because her friend lives on the other side of town, and it was very common for them to meet halfway.
Shortly after she left her home, her friend received an ominous text message from Taylor, who said that she felt as though somebody was following her. However, Taylor stopped replying to the text messages and never showed up at her friend's house. Within an hour of leaving home, Taylor's parents received a phone call from somebody who had found Taylor's abandoned mobile phone. When they discovered that Taylor hadn't shown up at her friend's house, they started to search around the area for her before reporting her missing at around 7:30 p.m. At 8:45 p.m., friends who had been searching for Taylor found her badly beaten body beside a railroad track close to Rosedale Avenue, around a 10-minute walk from her home. She was lying in a puddle of her own blood and was unconscious but still breathing. She was rushed to Vernon Jubilee Hospital and then transferred to Kelowna General Hospital, where she tragically died from her injuries. While there had been evidence of strangulation, it was blows to the head which ultimately killed Taylor. The area where Taylor had been found had houses on both sides of the tracks and was a popular shortcut used by hundreds of people each day. Investigators released a statement asking anybody who may have been in the area at the time to please come forward with any information, regardless of how small they think it may have been. They additionally asked the residents of Armstrong to remain vigilant and take a few extra steps to ensure personal safety. They asked people to travel in groups or ask parents or friends for a ride, as well as travel in areas that have good visibility. They also suggested letting friends or family know where they are going at all times and when you expect to arrive, as well as carry a cell phone. The murder left the residents of the tight-knit community feeling on edge, especially since no suspect had been identified. Investigators released a photograph of Taylor wearing her Halloween costume in the hopes that it would refresh the memory of anybody who may have seen her that evening. They also conducted a road check in the area of Pleasant Valley Road and Rosedale Avenue, hoping that somebody could have a lead on the case.
We live in a small town. It should be a nice, safe little place to live, and it kind of makes you nervous. I don't like it.
I think it hits really close to home. I mean, you don't expect this in a small community. It's pretty low crime rate.
On the 9th of November, police received an anonymous letter from somebody claiming responsibility for Taylor's murder. The letter also contained threats against more women in Armstrong. RCMP spokesman Corporal Dan Muskalic said that the letter contained very limited information regarding the details of the murder, and as a result, they had been unable to confirm that the letter had come from the killer. He asked for the letter writer to come forward and contact them via telephone or letter to create a dialogue and prevent further violence. He further revealed that an anonymous tip line had been implemented for anybody who had any information but wanted to remain anonymous. Towards the end of November, there was a massive breakthrough in the case when it was announced that the DNA in the case was matched to a 2005 sexual assault in Kelowna. While the sexual assault was unsolved, the victim had provided a description of her attacker, and investigators released a composite sketch of the suspect. The suspect DNA sample was not matched to the known offender DNA data bank. The man was described as a Caucasian man with a darker skin tone. At the time of the sexual assault, he was estimated to be 19 to 20 years old and had dark coloured eyes with short dark hair. He was estimated to be between 5 feet 8 inches tall to 5 feet 10 inches tall. He was of stocky build, but not particularly fit or muscular. He also had large, distinct sideburns and thick eyebrows. Investigators said that it was important for people to remember that the composite sketch was how the suspect looked back in 2005 and that they believed that the suspect was a resident of the Okanagan Valley. They stated that they believed that the suspect's friends or family held valuable information. In a statement, they said, "We ask that the residents of the Okanagan think back to the days just prior to Taylor's murder on Halloween night to see if they recall some form of conflict or personal upset on the days or day leading up to Halloween." It wouldn't be until April of the following year that two people were arrested in connection with Taylor's murder. 26-year-old Matthew Forster, a former resident of Cherryville, was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. He had been linked to the murder via DNA found underneath Taylor's fingernails. He was also facing additional charges in a 2004 home invasion in which a 19-year-old woman was sexually assaulted, as well as the 2005 sexual assault in Kelowna. His father, Stephen Ray Forster, was also arrested and charged with obstruction of justice, an accessory after the fact to murder. The arrests were a welcoming relief to residents of Armstrong, especially Taylor's family. Her mother, Mary, said that the family had been waiting for this news for months.
"We finally can direct our anger at a face. Now I know what evil looks like."
The following day, Matthew's second-degree murder charge was upgraded to first-degree murder. His father would subsequently be granted bail. The first-degree murder trial began in March of 2014. During opening statements, it was revealed that Matthew had admitted to murdering Taylor after she fought back when he attempted to rape her. A videotaped confession was played out during which Matthew expressed remorse for what he had done. there was an agreed statement of facts, which meant that the jury would only have to decide whether Matthew was capable of forming the intent for murder. Outside of court, Taylor's father Raymond spoke about the confession.
And I don't see nothing. I don't see any redness in the face coming up, no crinkling in the forehead, like the lines, you know, like nothing. You know, so like I was saying yesterday, it's like, it doesn't look like there's any remorse there at all. First the strangulation, and then whatever he used to bash her head in. Strangulation, if it had stopped there, maybe I could, you know, be a little bit more relaxed about it, you know, but to take it to the next level, you know, it's like, okay, you've made a mistake, you realize that, walk away. You made a mistake, it didn't work for you, but yet you carry on. There's intent right there.
It was revealed that when Taylor was walking to her friend's home, she sent a text message which read, "I'm being crept." Another partial message was waiting in her phone's queue, but she never finished it. Presumably, she had been attacked while writing the message. The jury then heard from RCMP Corporal Trevor Cook, who specialised in forensic identification section. He showed photographs of blood evidence that was collected at the scene. There was blood in the trees around where Taylor was laying, as well as on several items at the scene. He also testified that he had found blood evidence in Matthew's truck. Ultimately, Matthew would be found guilty of first-degree murder. In Canada, a first-degree murder conviction carries an automatic life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years. Following the verdict, his father Stephen pleaded guilty to accessory after the fact and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Stephen had gone to great lengths to help his son evade capture. When asked if he had anything to say to Taylor's family, he said, "I would like to apologise to the Van Diest family for prolonging the investigation. They've suffered more than anybody should." In December, Matthew pleaded guilty to the two other attacks that he was linked to. He was sentenced to another 12 years that would serve. He was sentenced to another 12 years that would be served concurrent to the life sentence he was already serving. One of the victims provided an impact statement and detailed how Matthew had ruined her life. She said that her head had been split open during the attack and she temporarily lost hearing and her jaw was damaged. She had muscle pain, but the most significant damage was emotional. As a tear rolled down her cheek, she said, "I will never be the person I was before the attack." In the wake of Taylor's murder, the city of Armstrong, in partnership with the Van Diest family, created the Taylor Jade Van Diest Memorial Trail. The pathway was built in memory of Taylor within the railroad corridor between Rosedale Avenue and Pleasant Valley Road. Trees, bushes, and uneven gravel were replaced by shrubs, plants, pavement, and fencing. Each year, a memorial walk takes place along the trail. As Taylor's mother said, "I'd like to give Armstrong a sort of sense of peace, and the trail that we created was certainly created in order to do that. Create a sense of peace, and dare I say, even serenity, when they walk along the tracks." On Halloween of 2010, 16-year-old Devin Griffin returned from church to his two-story family home in Ottawa County, Ohio. The home was extremely rural. It was situated on about 100 acres of land and around 200 feet from Route 2. When Devin entered the home, he went into his bedroom to play video games, completely unaware as to what horror had earlier unfolded. When he went into the master bedroom later on after noticing that nobody had emerged, he was met by a gruesome scene. His mother, Susan Liskey, and her husband, William Liskey, were lying in their bed, surrounded in a puddle of blood. A comforter had been pulled the whole way up to their heads. In another room lay the lifeless body of his brother, Derek Griffin. They had all been shot and then brutally bludgeoned with a claw hammer. At first, Devin believed it to be a Halloween prank, or even a prop left behind from the family's Halloween party on Saturday night. He described it as something out of a haunted house. When it quickly dawned on Devon that this was no prank, he ran outside and called his aunt, Laurie Morse, who rushed to the scene. When Laurie arrived, she called 911 as she walked through the house and uncovered the crime scene for herself.
We need an ambulance and the sheriff to show up, please. Where's the blood?
It's on the bed.
In their house? In their bed?
It's in their bed.
Okay.
As she entered the master bedroom, her shock became apparent.
I don't know. Girls in the bed. He's dead. He's got to be dead.
Okay. Did it look like maybe he was shot?
Oh, he's either shot or stabbed or something.
The 911 operator ordered Laurie to get out of the bedroom and not to touch anything. Laurie said that she didn't know where her sister, Susan, was, but added that she didn't lift the bed covers, so she could be in the bed. She said that there was a lot of blood and that William had either been shot or stabbed. Laurie gave the 911 operator the name of a potential suspect, William's 24-year-old son, William Jr.
His son DJ was here last night. They were going to go hunting. They've had a lot of trouble with him, with the law, and he's threatened Susie before.
The three victims had been discovered in their beds, and there had been no sign of a struggle or a break-in. William had been shot 5 times in the head and face at a range of about 1 or 2 feet. Susan had been shot 3 times at close range. Derek suffered blunt force trauma and likely died within a few minutes of the first blow. Inside the home, investigators discovered a claw hammer, which they believed to be the murder weapon.
After interviewing family members, deputies sent out a bulletin across the state for their suspect, 24-year-old William Liskey.
The investigation quickly shifted towards William Jr., who had a history of mental health issues. In 2002, William had called police when William Jr. had threatened to harm himself. At the time, William Jr. was on house arrest. When the officers arrived, William Jr. attacked them and faced charges in juvenile court of assaulting a peace officer. In 2004, William Jr. got into a fight with Susan and struck her in the chest. A few months later, he was charged with assault and robbery and accused of hitting Susan with a coffee cup and stealing her car. He was indicted on 1 count of felonious assault and 2 counts of robbery, both of which were second-degree felonies. 2 months later, he was found incompetent to stand trial, and he entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. He would later be found competent to stand trial, but the state would drop the charges. In fact, local police had been summoned to the Liskey residence on numerous occasions for disturbances relating to William Jr. Over the course of 2010, a number of misdemeanor counts were filed in court against William Jr., mostly for disorderly conduct. In April and June, he had pleaded no contest to disorderly conduct. The first case was handled as a minor misdemeanor, and the second was handled as a 4th-degree misdemeanor. In August, an obstruction of justice charge against him was dropped, but he was then found guilty once again of disorderly conduct. At the time of the murders, William Jr. had an outstanding arrest warrant for assault. On one occasion, William Sr. had called police after an argument with his son turned physical. He said that he had picked his son up from a halfway house so that he could come over to his house and see the rest of his family. He said, "He is a schizophrenic and he went off. I think he has not been doing his meds." He said that his son was angry and uncontrollable, but said that he did not want to press charges. He only wanted him to take his medication. Devon had informed investigators that the night before the murders, he had stayed overnight at his father's house. In the morning, he returned to get changed before heading out to church. While he was at the home getting changed, he saw William Jr. there. It wasn't known if the three victims were dead at this point, but Devon had placed William Jr. at the scene. This, combined with his violent history, led to him becoming the first and only suspect in the triple murder. Investigators issued a statewide alert for William Jr. with a warrant that he was armed and dangerous. At the time of the murders, William Jr. was living in a halfway house in Sandusky. However, he wasn't there.
As I understand it, he moved around an awful lot. This is where he would come periodically because of his parents. That we have some places in Oregon, Sandusky, things of that nature where he jumped around a little bit.
Around 3 hours after the bodies were found, William Jr. was tracked down to the family's cabin in Carroll County, around 170 miles away from the crime scene. He was arrested without incident. The following day, he appeared in court where bond was set at $1 million. In arguing for bond, prosecutor Mark Mulligan had said that investigators found evidence of premeditation, but he refused to elaborate any further. Despite William Jr.'s problems, the arrest came as a complete shock to his family. To add further to the tragedy, William's sister, Susan Dunmayer, died in a house fire just the following day. William Jr.'s uncle, Daryl Arthur, said, "I know William wasn't the perfect child, and he's had some problems, but I don't think anyone saw this coming. If he did do it, how do you shoot your own dad, and then add this tragedy to it?" A number of relatives would reveal that there were a number of other instances of violence from William Jr. When he was 18 years old, he had been kicked out of the house after he attacked Susan as she showered. They said that William Jr. had always had a strained relationship with his stepmother, but despite his issues, William had never given up on his son. When he was hospitalized in 2007 for schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type, he had filed for guardianship over him. He said that he wanted to protect his son and get him the help that he needed, and eventually wanted to see him in a halfway house or a group home. When William Jr. did move into the halfway home, William visited him all the time and always brought him back home to spend time with the rest of the family. In fact, just the week before the murder, William had taken William Jr. on a hunting trip, and they had returned home less than 24 hours before the murders had taken place. A number of neighbours of the family said that they had suspected that William Jr. had tortured and killed their pets. Mark Gradle's dog had been shot twice with .22 caliber bullets, and he had suspected that it was William Jr. A grand jury indicted William Jr. on 6 counts of aggravated murder. Prosecutor Mark Mulligan announced that they were still gathering information in the case and were still unsure as to what the motive was. He said, "Premeditation doesn't have to be over a long duration, and I think when all of the facts are known, it will be clear that there was some thought given to how the murders were committed, prior thought on how to accomplish the murders." He further stated that William Jr. would be facing the death penalty. William Jr. was sent for an evaluation at the Court Diagnostic and Treatment Centre in Toledo for competency to stand trial. The results of those evaluations were not made public due to a gag order. However, his lawyer subsequently requested a second competency hearing, so presumably, she wasn't pleased with the results. The second evaluation would determine that William Jr. was competent to stand trial. Because of the gag order in place, very little information regarding the murders were publicly released. However, in July, an investigative report was released which showed that either before or after murdering Susan, William Jr. had raped her. A rape kit and DNA testing had confirmed that semen found inside Susan was from William Jr. The investigative report also contained a letter that William Jr. sent to his cousin from behind bars. It read, "I wish this terrible thing would never have happened. I hope you and everyone else will eventually find peace and happiness through God's grace and try to forgive me. Tell everyone I said hi and that I love them and am very sorry." The following month, William Jr. pleaded guilty to 3 counts of aggravated murder. In exchange for the guilty plea, prosecutors agreed not to seek the death penalty against him and instead recommended that he be sentenced to life in prison without parole. He appeared in court to sign the plea agreement. A number of members of the family were in the courtroom, and a handful broke down in tears as the plea agreement was signed. Judge Bruce Winters asked William Jr. several times if he understood the impact of his admission that it allowed him to avoid a trial, to which William Jr. replied, yes. Details surrounding the murders were read out in court, and it was revealed that William Jr. had implicated himself in the crime shortly after his arrest. His mother had called him in jail, and the phone call had been recorded. She read her son out a newspaper article about the murders and said, "You did it. You did all of this." And William Jr. responded by confirming that he did. William Jr. would subsequently be sentenced to life in prison. When handing down the sentence, Judge Winters said, "The court is not in a position to make this whole. It is not in a position to bring back loved ones. The court can only hope to do justice." The family were also given the opportunity to provide an impact statement. Lori Morse, Susan's sister, said that they just wanted to understand why William Jr. had did what he did. She said, "I will never get the events of that day out of my head. We feel such crippling grief. We will never hear Susan's laughter or see Derek smile again or feel a big bear hug from Bill." William Jr. was given the opportunity to speak. He spoke about Satan and his struggle with mental illness. He said that Satan was, and still is, trying to destroy his soul. He said, "I cannot explain why it happened. Only my eternal struggle with mental illness caused by great affliction from the devil. I want to say I am extremely sorry. It's all my fault. I don't blame anyone but myself." He told the courtroom that he could still not understand why he had murdered his father, stepmother, and stepbrother, and said that he loved his father very much, and when he thought back to what he had done, it made him feel physically sick. On the 31st of March, 2015, William Jr. Litsky ended his own life at Ross Correctional Institute. His attorney, John Thebes, said that the suicide did not shock him, stating that William Jr. was mentally ill and would have been better suited in a mental health facility rather than a prison. It was Halloween night of 1984 when 31-year-old Doreen Herbert was out with her 5-year-old daughter, Deanna, trick-or-treating around their neighborhood in Berryessa, California. When they returned home, they sat down to watch a movie. The home was quieter than normal because Doreen's husband, Charles, was out for the night. Shortly after they returned home, there was a knock at the front door. Doreen opened the front door to find a man wearing a rubber wolf's mask and carrying a machete. He barged his way into the house and unleashed a brutal and sustained attack on Doreen, hitting her over and over again with the machete. As Doreen lay dying, the man used the machete to slice open her abdomen. Doreen was 8 months pregnant at the time. He ripped out Doreen's unborn child and tossed it to the floor before mutilating it and then leaving the house. Both Doreen and her unborn child had sustained severed limbs. When Charles arrived home that night at around 9:45 p.m., he discovered the gruesome crime scene. He found Deanna unharmed and cowering behind the sofa. Nearby, he found the rubber wolf's mask. He immediately called for an ambulance and held Doreen in his arms as he waited for help to arrive. Doreen was still clinging to life.
We ran out of the crime scene. That's when I looked and I noticed that the Halloween night, like a straight out of a Stephen King movie, Halloween night, there was lit jack-o'-lanterns on the steps up to the front door. And inside the front door where the body had laid, apparently, where the paramedics had picked her up from, Doreen, the blood was probably, it was coagulating. It was probably a couple inches thick. It was pretty thick. And I remember my boots sticking to the blood.
When police arrived at the scene, they immediately arrested Charles.
I could hear Charles screaming and yelling that, help my wife, I don't know what's going on. He was beside himself, absolutely beside himself, screaming and yelling, my wife, my wife, my wife.
He was unable to comfort his traumatized daughter and was unable to go to Alexei and Brothers Hospital with Doreen. Shortly after she arrived at the hospital, she was pronounced dead. Within 2 hours of the arrest, Charles would be released when it was revealed that Diana had witnessed the entire attack unfold as she hid behind the sofa. During the frenzied attack, the man's mask had fallen off, and Diana was able to identify the killer as her mother's ex-husband, 34-year-old William Dennis. Doreen and William had divorced in a bitter dispute back in 1978. They had a young son, Paul, who Doreen was granted full custody of after a custody battle. Doreen went on to remarry Charles, and they became the perfect nuclear family. As Charles said, he treated Paul like he was his own son.
Paul was a good boy. We loved animals, and we'd go fishing and camping quite a bit.
Then in 1982, 3-year-old Paul tragically drowned in a swimming pool accident. Following his death, William took Doreen and Charles to court for a wrongful death lawsuit, but ultimately, he lost. He was apprehended at his home around a mile away and booked in to the lockup ward at Valley Medical Center, where he was being treated for cut tendons on his hand. While Diana had identified William as the attacker and blood had been found in his pants, on his car keys, and in his garage, just 3 days later, William was released from jail. Minutes before court closed, the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office had decided that the evidence against him was insufficient and ordered that he be released. The release had come the night before Doreen's funeral and generated a widespread public outcry.
I'm sorry that it did happen to him. I hope they catch the person who did it.
Following his release, William called the Mercury News to deny that he had killed his ex-wife and her unborn baby, and to claim that the wound on his hand had been the result of a household accident. He stated, "I was playing around with a knife, flipping it, and I grabbed it wrong." The wound on his hand, however, had not come from a knife. The wounds were to 3 fingers and had cut all the way through the tendons down to the bone. The wound would have come from a machete-type instrument, much similar to the one that was used during the attack. However, less than 24 hours later, William was rearrested. According to Deputy District Attorney Alan Noodleman, the homicide unit chief who had decided against charging William, a breakthrough in the case had come through, and now they decided that they had enough evidence against William. While he had refused to elaborate on what the evidence was, he said, "The people of Santa Clara County can rest assured that analysis of evidence has now established that the right man is in custody." Police Chief Joseph McNamara provided a bit more information when he revealed that evidence which had been submitted to the laboratory had only been made available, and seemingly, the evidence linked back to William. He was careful not to criticize the district attorney's office for releasing William and said, "We regret that the community had to be disturbed by William being released." Under California law, the killing of a fetus can be charged as murder if it is developed enough to live independent of its mother. William was therefore charged with 2 counts of murder and was ordered to be held without bail. In December, the preliminary hearing began. Deputy District Attorney Alan Noodleman detailed how 2 coffin-like boxes had been discovered in William's garage. Over the handmade pine boxes, stitched green body bags had been draped. In front of the boxes, they had discovered 2 boat anchors. He went on to put forward the theory that the 2 boxes were for Doreen and Charles. They speculated that William had planned on murdering Doreen and Charles to avenge the death of his son, who had died while in their care. He said, "I think he planned an unpleasant death at sea. I think Mr. and Mrs. Herbert were intended to experience at sea exactly what Paul experienced." Following the preliminary hearing, it was determined that there was enough evidence for William to stand trial for the murders. He would subsequently plead not guilty to the murders. Because he was charged with 2 murders, Dennis would be facing the death penalty if convicted. In August of 1985, Charles sued the city of San Jose for his wrongful arrest. His suit also alleged negligence, violation of civil rights, and negligent infliction of emotional distress. The suit was seeking no specific amount, but asked for general damages, medical costs, lost wages, and other relief that the court may deem just and proper. According to Charles's attorney, Alan Fleissman, the arrest of Charles was made simply because Charles was covered in blood. He said, "It never made any sense to us. He had come upon a horrible scene. He was extremely upset, and they arrested him." The murder trial finally began in July of 1988. During opening statements, Deputy District Attorney Paul Licotti revealed early on that the blood found on William's clothing and inside his home had come from Doreen. She also revealed that the murder weapon had never been recovered, but a label from an 18-inch machete was found inside William's home. Furthermore, the rubber wolf's mask that was found at the crime scene was identical to one that William had wore to a Halloween party just the year beforehand. She said, "You will recognize the mask, and you will recognize the defendant for what he is, a murderer." The very first witness was Deanna. She was now 8 years old. In a quiet but clear voice, Deanna said that as they settled down for the evening, they heard a knock at the door. She said that her mother went to open the door, thinking that it was another trick-or-treater. She said, "My mommy said, 'Get out of my house,' and he said, 'I'm going to kill you.' My mommy told me to hide behind the couch, so I did." Much of the trial focused on the wolf mask, which had been found inside Doreen's home. Investigators had struggled to find the makers of the mask. They canvassed shops in the Bay Area and mailed photographs of the mask to costumers and novelty producers. Finally, they were able to track it down. It was one of 20,000 manufactured in North Hollywood and designed by Dawn Post Studios. During the trial, the mask was displayed over a styrofoam head. The eye holes were surrounded by white orbs and stare over the extended snout, topped with a black nose. There were 2 fangs that protruded from the mouth, as well as a red tongue and a chilling grin. A taped interview was played out during which William professed that he was innocent. In the recording, he told investigators that he had not been to the Herbert home in more than 4 years. In the same recording, William was asked if he ever recollected dressing up for Halloween, and he said that he had dressed up as a clown, a pirate, and as the Lone Ranger. Neither he nor the investigators ever mentioned the wolf mask. There was an unexpected twist in the trial when William's lawyer, Tito Gonzalez, admitted for the first time that his client had indeed murdered Doreen and her unborn baby. However, he said that William was deranged at the time of the murders over the death of his son. He said, "This was the explosion of the mind rather than a carefully conceived plot." He told the jury that after his son had died, William began to fantasize about killing Doreen and Charles. A psychiatrist hired by the defense then testified that he had no idea that his ex-wife was pregnant at the time of the murder. Dr. Samuel George Benson Jr. told the jury that when Doreen opened the door that night, she had only opened it slightly so that he could not see that she was pregnant. He said that the attack had begun when Doreen's back was towards him, and he claimed he did not know that she was pregnant until the amniotic fluid gushed out. The doctor had diagnosed William as suffering a major depressive episode at the time of the murders that had been aggravated by a dependent personality disorder. According to the doctor, William first of all blamed himself for his son's death before placing that blame onto Doreen and Charles. He said that William strongly believed that they wanted Paul dead. William's defense had argued that because of his mental health issues, William should not be sentenced to death. After a 2-week trial, the jury were sent away to deliberate. They found William Dennis guilty of first-degree murder and second-degree murder. The verdict was unsurprising due to the fact that it had been admitted that William had in fact murdered Doreen and her unborn son. During the sentencing phase, the jury recommended a death sentence for William. It was now up to Santa Clara County Superior Court Judge John Schatz to review their recommendation before returning with a verdict. Ultimately, the judge would agree. He said that the aggravating factors in the case outweigh any mitigating circumstances, and William was sentenced to death. While William committed arguably one of the most heinous murders in California's history, many of his loved ones and friends still support him.
Destroyed his life. I mean, the hope of him ever having a family again of his own and another child. Obviously, that's never going to happen. So, yeah, it destroyed his life and those around him. I get that Mike is very sorry for the fallout, for the people that were harmed. You know, his family, her family. And this may sound hard, but I've never heard him say he was sorry for what happened to Doreen, that he feels it was justified. And that's tough. I mean, I think I understand it's legal precedent. I understand that's the basis of his appeal. I understand that his belief that she murdered his child and therefore he had an obligation to make that right. And that's hard, but I think that's deeply how he feels.
William Dennis still remains on San Quentin's death row. Well, guys, that is it for this very special episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. This episode isn't like anything else I've ever done on Morbidology, so I'd love to know what you think about it and whether you'd like to hear more special episodes. I really do appreciate all of the support and thought that a special episode for spooky season would be a great way to show my gratitude. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing Halloween.